Shane, your bags are packed.
Yeah, I have a suitcase with me today.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Ciudad Mexico,
Ooh.
Which is also known as Mexico City.
But that will mean traveling through an airport.
Yes, I'm not driving.
Two airports.
Yes. Well, no, just one. Well, actually two.
No, two.
The one from which I depart and the one to which I arrive.
Okay, so correct. Be careful when you're in the airport about people with syringes.
Like who want to give me a vaccine?
Yeah, or people wearing LOL t-shirts.
It's going around these days.
Poison-tipped needles.
They'll get you.
And don't let anybody wipe anything on your face.
Yeah. It's so Cold War.
Yeah, it's very Cold War.
It's kind of romantic.
So if I'm like, if I see two women coming towards me with LOL t-shirts and they're laughing with big syringes going, I should probably run the other way.
Yeah, that would be good.
That's just basic OPSEC training right there.
Don't stay for the joke.
Hi, are you the welcoming wagon? Are those margaritas? Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Death Without Dignity edition. I'm Shane Harris of the Wall Street Journal. Hope I die with dignity one day. I'm going to die with my boots on.
Yeah, just don't die in an airport
with
a woman with a syringe.
That's the worst, man. That is not the way
they
you want
to die. They just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, at least the uncle who he killed with an anti-aircraft gun. Now that has panache.
Right.
Or the dogs, right?
There's been dogs. This has been, for those who don't know, of course, we're talking about the half-brother? The late half-brother of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, who was killed by two women in a Malaysian airport with poison darts or needles of some kind.
Can I just say that to all of our listeners who may have half-brothers that they have problems with, this is not an appropriate
there
way
to... There are better ways to
talk it out, man.
Yeah. Family therapy.
angry exchanges.
Do want to know if there's a committee in North Korea, though, that comes up with creative methods of assassinating unwanted family members.
Because you do have the my favorite one is the killing of the uncle with the anti-aircraft gun. Then I think they fed his parts to dogs rather than allow him to be buried.
And they made him watch other people being killed with anti-aircraft guns in advance of his own. So it's, first you get to see it and then you get to do it.
Yeah.
That's I thought the dark. British had this a lock is taken on sadism. A dark. Yeah.
Yeah. That's messed up.
Anyway, have fun in Mexico. Thanks. Bring me back one of those sombreros and a margarita. We'll
yes,
chill
the
out.
Sombrero with they're a so syringe. Famous for it. Of course, you know my good friends, Ben Wittist, Mark Hoffman Wittist, and Susan Hennessy. Hi, guys.
Hi.
No meals for you.
Hey.
Today on the show, first, we're going to talk about President Trump's selection of Army General H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor after a turbulent search. Next, we'll talk about that incident at the airport. And finally, we're going to look at what to make of the burgeoning relationship between Bibi Netanyahu and Donald Trump.
But wait.
What?
I have a special announcement.
Oh, you have
first.
A special announcement?
Yeah. So we got on Friday a wonderful shout out from Mike Pesca.
Pesca of the Gist.
Of the Gist, who is one of my favorite talkers in any venue, let alone podcasts. But the result of this is that we have a surge of new listeners who over the weekend downloaded the last episode. And so I just wanted to say, to everyone who's listening to Rational Security for the first or maybe the second time, welcome aboard.
Hi, guys. Hi. And if you don't give us a 5-star review, we will hunt you down with an anti-aircraft gun and
I
feed you to a dog. Girls.
We will come for you.
Guys, I was going to say something like, thanks for subscribing. We'll try really hard not
except
to bore you.
Except for Tammy. She's going to do that. But the rest
Tammy
of us.
Is the peacemaker.
This is called
I'm a
so
diplomat
you know.
Here in the crowd.
You are. Tammy is our resident
Susan's
diplomat.
Our bad cop. Tammy is our good cop. No, in all seriousness, if you like the show, we are totally word of mouth. We've got no advertising. We've got no sponsorship. So,
which you will learn soon enough. Yeah,
So, if you like the show, rate us. Share us on Facebook and Twitter. And you know, we're glad to have you guys aboard.
Definitely. All right, so let's get to the big news of the week. So we're taping this on Tuesday, and on Monday, President Trump announced H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor. So just briefly on General McMaster, I think probably fair to say one of the more celebrated, well-regarded generals of his generation.
And like Matt, is seen as an intellectual warrior.
Right. He's a PhD. He wrote a very well-regarded book on Lyndon Johnson and what he saw as the terrible advice that he was given during the Vietnam War by his generals. Probably the two most famous military campaigns he's been involved in. One was the first Gulf War, where he led a famous battle in a tank battalion, or tank regiment, sorry. And then also he is responsible for basically helping to take Tal Afar in Iraq during the second Iraq War from ISIS, from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which of course became ISIS. So seen as sort of, I think, in the vein of a Petraeus, kind of this, you know, insurgency, counterinsurgency thinker, and a obviously still serving in the military. It's notable that this is a path that others have taken to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So maybe we'll talk a little bit about what McMaster might have his eyes on.
So doing a little Colin Powell.
A little Colin Powell. A little, you know, who else? Who else? Did anybody else go from National
John Negroponte and Poindexter?
No, Poindexter was left it his.
Oh, no, I just mean he was active military.
Yeah, exactly. And Negroponte was never NATSEC advisor, but Scowcroft, right?
Al Haig.
Al Haig. Okay. So there's precedent for it. Why don't we first start with, let's start with McMaster, and then let's talk about the search that led to McMaster and what that might say about his tenure. Who has some thoughts on?
Yeah, so look, as we've seen in the past, right, sort of the parade of terribles and not so terrible, and then the choice emerges. And so at least part of the reaction is colored just by a general sense of relief. You know, that said, this is clearly a choice that's being embraced by kind of the mainstream national security and intelligence community, saying, you know, this is a good, solid choice. You know, the real question becomes on sort of on what conditions did he accept the job and how is he actually going to do it, right? So clearly this is a sane person. This is not someone who subscribes to some of the sort of more troubling strains of Islamophobia and sort of other stuff that we've seen emerging from the White House. And so, you know, the real question in terms of whether or not he will be effective is really a question of whether or not he's going to be forced to retain K.T. McFarland as his deputy, either in title or in practice, whether or not he's going to be able to disband this sort of shadow NSA, the strategic initiatives group that Bannon has sort of constructed, and so what kind of control he's going to be able to assert. So to the extent that he comes in and is able to play sort of a traditional national security advisor role, is able to make those personnel and policy choices, you know, an excellent choice and certainly rather reassuring, you know, deep ties to DOD and lots of different parts of sort of the relevant stakeholders here. Like many of the people who were selected sort of in that vein of being reassuring, the real test is how exactly does he wield his power within the White House and is he able to stand up to some of those more troubling elements?
So I would agree with you about that sort of Kremlinology aspect about how things work inside the White House and will he actually have autonomy and influence. But I think there's another element, which is that, as we already knew, Trump loves a man in uniform. And here's another example of a senior officer or retired senior officer getting a senior position in the national security hierarchy. And I think there are sort of dueling reactions among the national security establishment to this. On the one hand, as with Mattis's appointment, there's sort of this sigh of relief, like, oh, thank God, another grown up in the room.
Yeah.
Although, as you point out, it's not clear what room he's in. Or whether he's allowed to leave it. But I think there's also, you know, all the potential vulnerabilities that we've talked about earlier on the show of having yet another person who comes from a military background, exclusively a military background, in a senior civilian, usually civilian national security position. And, you know, the question I would have is whether McMaster knows what he doesn't know and whether he will be able to not just control personnel in his own operation, but will he be able to establish a regular order in national security policymaking where the civilians who have roles to play from the Treasury Department, the Commerce Department, the State Department, the intelligence community are able to bring their voices to the table as well. And I think what's encouraging about McMaster is that he, you know, clearly in his LBJ book, in the Vietnam book, you know, wrestles with issues of the relative weight given to political and military considerations in policymaking in that specific instance. And so he's clearly at least somewhat sensitive to it. But, you know, walking the walk is a little bit different from doing the post facto analysis. And I, you know, given the overall weight in the national security establishment of this administration toward the military, and particularly the fact that the leadership seems hostile to the intelligence community, you know, and a good national security advisor is going to have to bend over backwards to be a fair broker and to bring those discounted voices into the room. And that's a tough task.
So I would just say the national security advisor has two roles, and one of which is mostly under his control, although you know, how impaired he will be in that role remains to be seen. I'll talk about that in a second. The other role is actually not in his control. So the role that's not in his control is that he's actually, as the title suggests, the principal advisor to the president on national security matters. He does not make national security decisions himself. He's the person who whispers in the president's ear and tees up decisions for the president to make. You can have the best national security advisor in the world, and if you're not to put too fine a point on it, a freaking nutcase, it might not help your national decision making all that much. So I think we're going to learn from the rationalization of this process a little bit more about whether Trump is quite as kooky in his own national security thinking as we've all had reason and occasion to suspect, or whether a more disciplined set of advisors can help in this regard. On the first point, the first function, look, the national security advisor can do a lot to have a good process. But if he is constantly undermined by a deputy who is, shall we say, a little eccentric and not of the highest caliber, by staff on the National Security Council, I don't mean to dwell on Mr. Gorka, but who is even more eccentric and ideologically extreme, and by people outside the National Security Council bureaucracy like Bannon, who, as Susan points out, has sort of running a shadow NSC operation, that is, you know, you could really still have dramatic interruptions in the process that even a very good national security advisor wants to run at that point. And so I think it's a dramatic improvement over Flynn. On the merits, it's one of the best appointments the president has made in any sphere. And whether he will be enabled in doing an effective job is very much remains to be seen. And I think the key initial test of it will be what happens to KT McFarlane.
So that's a great point, Ben. And on that, I think it's probably worth going back and just briefly recapping what happened in the past week since we recorded the podcast and we first began with Mike Flynn's death watch on day one.
Very
and
brief,
for about 12 hours. But I think it reveals a lot about what McMaster is stepping into, and frankly, the chaos of it and a lot of the uncertainty. So Flynn submits his letter of resignation. We find out then that Trump says that he fired him because he had misled the vice president. Trump later in a press conference says, yes, I did that, but Flynn was very treated very unfairly by the media and also by the intelligence community that seems to be leaking about him. So it's not clear whether he was fired because Trump felt he had to let him go or because he'd actually misled people. And then Bob Harward emerges, a retired vice admiral, as the leading candidate. It seems like he's possibly going to take the job. Everyone's ready. Then, oh no, just kidding. He doesn't take the job. after thinking about it for a while, reportedly because of his own financial issues. He was making a lot of money at Lockheed Martin, but he couldn't have control over staffing. So down with that one. Another search ensues. Up comes now McMaster, and the White House is insisting, no, 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 this time he will have control over staffing, we promise.
Oh, and don't forget that in the middle, David Petraeus, another rumored candidate,
yes,
was quoted publicly at the Munich Security Conference saying, well, anyone who takes this job would need to have control over staffing.
Right, which suggests that he either, you know, couldn't get those assurances if he was even offered the job. That's not clear to me. But clearly his name was floating around.
Yeah, maybe he just wanted to take himself out of the running.
Right,
who knows?
Right. So there has been this very these conflicting explanations about Flynn being let go. There's obviously the cloud of the Russia investigation still hanging over him, and Democrats in Congress are not.
What's that? Oh, there's an issue with Russia. I've forgotten
about
all about that.
Something about Russia and phone calls. But I think that it's revealing because, I mean, as Susan pointed out in the beginning, this key question of whether he's going to have control over the staff, it sounds like, at least from what the White House is trying to convey, we went from no control over the staff to control over the staff in the span of about 48 hours.
Well,
and if that's accurate, that's a massive shift in thinking.
And also, you know, if you have control over the staff, was it with the understanding that you wouldn't dismiss the staff? Right.
Right.
And
control over the staff, except for a certain group of people that, you know,
the president is attached to.
Look, but we have a relatively obvious sort of test for that, which is that there is no rational mainstream person, including McMaster, who would voluntarily keep KT McFarland as the deputy. This is one of the most difficult, complex, high energy, expertise requiring jobs in the entire U.S. national security apparatus.
Good slipping in there of high energy.
Yeah. Well, and I'll note that it's very interesting in that regard that when Sean Spicer announced that McMaster was getting the job, in the same tweet, he announced that Kellogg would be staying as chief of staff. Kellogg, who has been acting national security advisor. Chief of staff of the NSC is not typically a very senior level job. It's the person who manages the paper and the process. It's usually a mid-level job. And so the fact that Kellogg is staying on in that role made me think, okay, McFarland's going to keep the deputy title, but Kellogg is going to be doing the deputy job.
Yeah, that's a good insight. And Trump kept saying, in fact, when Trump made the announcement, Kellogg, right, was sitting next to him on the couch with McMaster and said the two of these guys together is going to be a very special team.
Yes, see?
That's what you would describe as the deputy in the National Security Advisor.
Right, and just to be clear about why we're all obsessing about the deputy role here, the deputy National Security Advisor has a very specific and important function that people out who sort of haven't, you know, played in federal government waters may not have a sense of, which is that she and both the current and former deputy national security advisors are female, run the deputies committee meeting, which is the principal functioning of the interagency.
The deputy secretary of state, defense.
Right. All the deputies get together in a room and the deputy national security advisor presides over that. And, you know, in most agencies, the deputy is the person who, on a functional day-to-day level, runs the agency. And so, you know, to have a deputies committee meeting supervised by somebody who, you know, we've all heard wacky stories about, and some of them are really wacky, and it is fair to say she is not admired. Particularly after the previous deputy, who was very deeply admired, that is a recipe for dysfunction.
Right. I mean, look, it's the deputies committee becomes so incredibly important because it's where those hard decisions are really hashed out. Sort of the decisions that are, or the options that are presented to the principals and to the president really are sort of, you know, those, all the rough edges have been smoothed off, right? And only sort of those really, really key choices get made up to the top. And so that person's sort of intellect and control over the process itself actually has a really important, plays a really important part in terms of what kinds of options are placed on the president's desk ultimately. And that's why it's such an important role. You know, look, we've seen that Trump and sort of the Trump team has not been hugely wedded to titles in the past, right? So people who are really sort of obsessed with the selection of Reince Priebus over Bannon for the chief of staff, you know, clearly those are people who are still thinking about the chief of staff being this really particular position. You know, we've seen over the past month that, you know, Trump doesn't care so much who has what title. So once again, you know, I think that this is an area in which sort of the people who are familiar with the process are really going to be focused on that role and what that job is, but that the titles just are not necessarily going to match moving forward.
You would like to think that the person in that job has an understanding walking in, at least say that it is a full-time job.
Okay, but that ship has sailed. So, I mean,
Because it's
kind of
deputy doesn't mean part time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I would set up the firing of KT McFarland as the marker of success or failure for the new National Security Advisor. I think it's going to be more a question of whether this is somebody who can bring all the range of relevant perspectives to bear on the decisions that are put in front of the president. And that's about regular order more broadly than it is about people.
But I will say that if and when KT McFarland is let go, she is more than welcome to join us as a guest on Rational Security.
Totally.
Yeah, because she's got a lot of experience on broadcast.
33 days of experience in government.
Right, broadcasting. No. She'd be cool. She'd be fun to have on the show. Okay, let's move on to the story that we all really want to talk about now. Kim Jong-nam, the estranged half-brother of North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, murdered in a Malaysian airport, reportedly by two women wearing LOL t-shirts.
I think just one was wearing the LOL
One was wearing an LOL t-shirt? Yeah.
The okay, other one so wasn't like laughing. Brigade.
The other one was not laughing. She might have been
out loud
inside,
or otherwise.
With poison needles. A man has been arrested. A man named Ri Jong-chol reportedly has been arrested. We don't have too many more details, I think, on that at this point in connection with it. This is seriously like something out of like John Lacare meets Quentin Tarantino. It's just wild, spectacular.
It's more Tarantino than Le Carré.
Right. It is just nutty. And Susan, you've been following some of the details about this. What do we know at this point about this scene in the Malaysian airport?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is just utterly bizarre, made even more bizarre by the spectacle of actually the closed circuit TV footage has now been released, so you can actually watch it happen. And it is, it's Tarantino-esque, this sort of weird, you know, these women come up and, you know, maybe stuck him with a syringe, wiped poison on his face. Just an incredibly sort of bizarre thing. Lots of speculation that this was directed by the North Koreans, although they are denying the allegation. The Brotherhood lived in exile in Malaysia. Sort of the older sibling, presumed successor or heir, until I think he tried to enter Japan on a fake passport, and his father had sort of sidelined him over that episode.
He had to go to Disney World, as I recall.
Excellent. Worth it. Totally worth it. So this is it's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, you know, it's interesting sort of you know, Kim Jong-un's you know, sort of ruthless treatment of his various family members. You know, I think he's killed uncles and you know, all kinds of challengers at this point. So yet another example, a colorful execution of his political opponents. The other is that it occurred in such a public and brazen way, and so how exactly that's going to blow back on the Chinese and what that's going to do for the China-North Korea relationship. So for a long time, China has sort of been propping up North Korea, taking sort of a lot of a responsibility, right, shielding them from human rights abuses. And at the same time, North Korea has gone a little bit rogue on the Chinese, that they've ignored sort of Chinese warnings about, you know, not getting overly aggressive on their nuclear or ballistic missile programs. There was a significant amount of tension that occurred after North Korean hacks of Sony, right? So sort of reaching out into the United States. There was a little bit of a sense in China that, hey, you know, this is, you've become more trouble than you're worth at this point. And so that relationship is already in a relatively stressful position. And so sort of each time there's a new episode of sort of North Korea getting lots and lots of international attention and lots of international criticism, once again, we hear sort of calls for, hey, maybe this is the breaking point in terms of the relationship between China and North Korea moving forward. This is going to be the thing that China finally says, you know, forget it, we're cutting you loose. You know, remains to be seen. But I think that's kind of the most, all the bizarre spectacle aside, that's actually the most sort of important or interesting foreign policy element of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical that this would be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of Chinese willingness to give the North Koreans a little scope in the international community and to deflect some international pressure on North Korea. North Korea is just such useful leverage for the Chinese internationally. But I do think the public setting and the third country setting for this are important, particularly at a moment when China sees opportunity because of relative disarray or relative disinterest from the United States to expand its own influence in East Asia and in Southeast Asia, and you know, to have this happen in Malaysia in an airport with all of the implications that has for international exchange, for trade and tourism, you know, it might present a little bit more of a challenge. But I suspect this is a something that serves the North Korean leader in that it adds to his prestige and his sort of dominance factor. And while it may upset the Chinese a little bit, it's an isolated incident. He's probably not going to go around assassinating all kinds of people in all kinds of international airports. And so
probably
I doubt
not
it's,
Mexico City.
Yeah.
80%.
Shane, don't worry. 80%. It's not going to happen in Mexico City. And, you know, but if you see that T-shirt, I think that's really the marker right there. But I just don't think this is going to disrupt the relationship that much.
Well, but didn't the Chinese in the immediate aftermath of it suspend coal imports from North Korea?
Okay.
I mean, that's
pretty low cost.
Well, it's low, but it's not low cost to the North Koreans. I mean, the North Koreans, a huge percentage of their economy is based on natural resource exports to China, which accounts for, China, I think, accounts for 90% of their foreign trade or something. And so, I think if you imagine that this reflects Chinese impatience and that China is starting to use resource delivery to the North Koreans and imports from the North Koreans as a lever, that's a potentially very significant thing. Now, I don't know if that's related primarily to the missile launch or whether it's related to this or whether it's related to just a sort of growing sense that Kim Jong-un needs to be swatted down a few pegs, and sort of like what the motivation behind the Chinese action was is a little bit opaque to me, but I do think it's something to watch.
I wonder whether, even if that's the case, Ben, if the United States is in a position to take advantage of that. I guess I'm very skeptical of that.
I wonder too. Well, could they do it this way? I mean, insofar as, and this may be an area where President Trump kind of has an ability to play sides off of each other, but obviously he wants to curtail the ballistic missile program. We had, you know, the spectacle of them finding out at Mar-a-Lago that the launch had happened, but those sort of, you know, kind of overtly kind of bumbling responses aside, clearly, you know, it's the policy of his administration to stop North Korea from developing a weapon. President Obama conveyed the seriousness of this to him in their private meeting in the Oval Office before the inauguration. I mean, Trump is looking for ways to make deals with China. And if one way they can do that is by kind of going in together against North Korea, I mean, don't we think that he would take that avenue?
I think he would, but I think Obama would have too. And I think and Bush would have before that. I mean, I'm not sure why the opportunity for cooperation with China on North Korea is better today than it was 2 years ago, or for that matter, during Bill Clinton's term, right? I mean, successive presidents have faced the same incentive structure as this one has does now, and all of them have better decision-making processes than the current one does. So I'm not sure I understand what the opportunity that presents for Trump that didn't present for the previous ones, unless he's facing increased Chinese impatience that the others were not.
But I think it's more than sort of just Chinese impatience, because of course one of the things that has changed, the sort of the facts on the ground that have changed is since, you know, the Clinton and even sort of later in the Obama presidency, is that North Korea actually has moved further towards actually achieving nuclear capabilities or ICBMs, right? They're getting, they're becoming more threatening in reality to the rest of the world. This does increase pressure on China. It makes it as that threat becomes more realistic. I think it's, you know, it's reasonable to wonder whether or not Chinese leadership is going to start viewing pressure from both sides, not just the international community, but also internally. You know, 500,000 Chinese soldiers died defending North Korea in the Korean War. You know, there is still historical memory about the very, very real costs of sort of going too far in on that particular relationship and the way that there can be really significant blowback. As sort of North Korea takes steps that raise the specter of a potentially real conflict or really serious international response, I do think China may start to feel quite differently. And it's not just a matter of sort of North Korea testing their patience, but also their own political pressure and the pressure of the international community.
You know, I'll just put a marker down on one thing a little bit to the side of the North Korea issue, or maybe something that the North Korea issue illustrates, which is, you know, there's been a lot of kind of flailing on the liberal side of the national security spectrum about how Trump doesn't understand global interdependence, doesn't understand the need for multilateralism in confronting global challenges. And they often talk about disease or climate change or migration. But I actually think it may be the missile threat that is going to compel some hard lesson learning by President Trump about the value of multilateral cooperation, because we've got the North Koreans, we've got the Iranians, and now we have the deployment of this Russian system. And it's quite clear that this is, you know, that there's no unilateral American response to intercontinental ballistic missiles. it's something that requires cooperation with a lot of countries. And it's something that if done smartly, enables you to bring together countries that may be your adversaries on other security issues, or at least, you know, your rivals on other security issues, but who share that concern about the missile threat. So, you know, maybe we will see that evolution in the Trump administration's thinking. We can hope so.
Let's move on to our third topic. So Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Washington last week for a joint press conference and a meeting with President Trump. Obviously, two guys who have known each other for a while, but this is the first time that they've appeared together in their official capacity. We can talk about what some of the things that came out of that press conference and some of the things that President Trump said. But Tamara, why don't you start us off by talking about what Netanyahu is dealing with at home right now? Because, you know, we think that Donald Trump's got problems with investigations and clouds about Russians over his head. Bibi's in not such calm waters either.
Oh, my goodness. You know, you got to feel for Netanyahu a little bit. He's been in...
Nah.
He's been in the prime minister's chair this second go-round since 2009, and he's been waiting the whole time for a Republican president who is going to, you know, relieve him from pressure to make compromises with the Palestinians. And he finally gets him. And now Netanyahu may be facing the fight of his political life, because he is subject to not one, not two, not three, but four police investigations in different cases. We don't know anything about the fourth, although we know that it exists from news reporting in Israel. But the other three are each interesting and different and special in their own way. One case alleges that Netanyahu and his wife and his son received extravagant gifts of champagne and cigars from a Hollywood mogul. And Netanyahu, questioned about this, said he just had no idea that there was so much, or that it was so valuable. Which makes you wonder, like, who was smoking these cigars? Was Sarah Netanyahu downing all these cigars? There is also an investigation, which has been just incredibly dramatic, with recorded phone calls between Netanyahu himself and the publisher of Yediot Ahronot, which until a few years ago was Israel's leading paper. And in these phone calls, the publisher and Netanyahu are discussing a quid pro quo whereby Netanyahu, who is also the communications minister, would use his authority to reduce the market share of a free newspaper, Yisrael Hayom, and to help Yediot Ahronot get its market share back. And in return, Yediot would provide favorable coverage of the prime minister.
And just to be clear, Yisrael Hayom is a publication, a free publication that is set up to promote Bibi.
Right. So then he could have two favorable newspapers.
Or he would even sort of scuttle the paper that was created to advance him if Yediot would become the paper that was...
It also makes no pretense about being that paper, right? And people just read it to see what basically what Netanyahu's
some people call
thinking.
It Bibi Hayom.
And these conversations are incredibly explicit. They talk about specific reporters and columnists who have to be muzzled and or hired. And these have been played on primetime Israeli TV, so the whole country has gotten to listen to them. And then the third investigation that we know the details about is on an entirely different subject, which is whether Netanyahu basically threw a contract for new submarines for the Israeli Navy to Germany, to a particular company in Germany, and whether he did that over the objections of the defense establishment and the then defense minister, Bogi Yaalon, who was essentially canned by Netanyahu. So it's each of these three, any one of them in and of themselves is a significant scandal, but the combination of the three is irresistible. You see the knives out in Israel, and all of this meant that Netanyahu's visit to Washington, the warm embrace of Donald Trump, was exactly the distraction that he needed. But somehow, after Netanyahu's bitter, bitter time with Obama, the idea that demonstrating he's shoulder to shoulder with the United States is enough to, help him survive this political firestorm at home, I just don't think it sells the way it used to.
Do you think that explains sort of the shift in the administration's policy and then the shift again, right? So we have, the historic, sort of position on the two-state solution. And then all of a sudden we have Trump saying maybe there's alternatives to the two-state solution. Then we have Nikki Haley saying you were committed to the two-state solution, and where the hell is Rex Tillerson? Right? Is this
where
because
in the world is Rex Tillerson? This is actually
a
worthy
question.
We should ask every week on the podcast.
Right. So is this sort of shift? Is it because Trump hasn't made up his mind about the policy? Is it just sort of what we're seeing is like his careless rhetoric if he just says whatever he wants to? Or is it because this partner maybe is not going to be his partner for much longer, and so he's sort of gaming out the alternatives?
Trump is gaming out the alternatives, or Netanyahu is gaming out the alternatives?
The Trump is gaming out the alternatives.
Oh, he's thinking maybe whoever replaces Netanyahu will not be a two-stater, and so he should have the door open.
But then he returns to embrace the two-state again. So it's sort of
you're giving Trump way too much credit here. That he's playing a months in advance post BB chess match where he's imagining the regime that comes after BB. No way. This is Trump shooting from the hip, as he has done about every foreign policy issue.
But he didn't know what the two-state solution
was. One China,
right?
Two Chinas, five or six Chinas, the president in Taiwan. I love Pakistan. I love the Pakistanis are great in conversations with the Pakistani president. I mean, I don't think there's any reason to read anything into that but Trump being Trump.
Well, okay, I'm going to add a little bit of I don't think the explanation is as you suggest, Susan, but I do think that Israeli domestic politics plays a role here because any any briefing he might have gotten, even the 30-second version, would include the fact that many of Netanyahu's coalition partners are not two-staters. And it was reported in the Israeli press that before Netanyahu left for Washington, his major coalition partner, Naftali Bennett of the Jewish Home Party, essentially warned him or threatened him, if there is any discussion of a Palestinian state in Washington, I'm bringing down the government. And so you will notice that whatever crazy stuff Trump may have said, Netanyahu did not mention a Palestinian state. He did not mention two states. And if, you know, if Netanyahu or any of his staff prepping the visit explained to the American side this this domestic political complication, then maybe that's what was reflected in Trump's remarks. Just some sort of, oh, I recognize you don't want to get pushed on two states, so I'll say two states, one state, whatever you want. You know,
so this brings me to my favorite Bibi Netanyahu joke, which I think if I miss this opportunity to tell on Rational Security, I will be punished in the next life. So God decides he's going to end the world, and he tells three people. He tells Donald Trump, he tells Vladimir Putin, and he tells Bibi Netanyahu. And Donald Trump calls in Steve Bannon to his office and says, Steve, I got good news and bad news for you. The good news is there really is a God. You know, the premise of our fight against the communists was right. There really is a God. And the bad news is he's going to end the world tomorrow. And Putin calls in Sergei Lavrov and he says, Sergei, I've got bad news and bad news. The bad news is, you know, the premise of our fight against the West was wrong. There really is a God. We were wrong the whole Soviet era. And the further bad news is not only is there is a God, he's going to end the world tomorrow. And Bibi calls in Naftali Bennett and he says, Naftali, I've got good news and good news. The first good news is that the millennial struggle of the Jewish people is vindicated. There really is a God. And the further good news is after tomorrow, we will not have to worry about a Palestinian state.
Oh, nothing like some dark humor to get you through the tough times.
Through these times. All right. Why don't we move on to object lessons? Does anybody particularly want to go first?
I can go.
You want to go first?
So, you know, we were talking earlier about H.R. McMaster, and one of the elements of the lore surrounding H.R. McMaster as an intellectual military strategist is this reading list that he put together a few years ago in an interview with, I think, McKinsey. And he's, you know, essential reads for professionals involved in military affairs. And Tom Ricks wrote about it at the time. And over the weekend, on the news of McMaster's appointment, you know, was tweeting about this reading list. And it was noted to Tom that this reading list is exclusively male and almost entirely Western in terms of the authors of the books and the perspectives on military strategy. Now, given that we're talking about military strategy, it may be not entirely surprising that it is male-dominated. But in any event, Tom is interested, and I'm very interested, in adding to this list some perspectives that may bring a little diversity, both in terms of the identity of the authors and the history and culture that's brought to bear on this very, very rich subject. So I'm calling on readers or listeners to submit your nominations. Tweet at Rational Security, RATL Security, your favorite female and or non-Western security studies books. And I promise I will share them with Tom Ricks.
Nice. So I'll do my object next. One of the great things about writing for the Wall Street Journal is so many people read my work. One of the other great things is so many people like to write in to tell me what they thought of my work. Mm-hmm. You know, we print our email address at the bottom of our articles.
Your
which is
actual
very helpful.
Actual email?
Yeah, our work email address.
Wow.
Yeah, it's there. So I probably received last week, in response to one story I wrote, I'm going to guess about 50 emails of people demanding to know, not demanding to know, but demanding that I not refer to Donald Trump as Mr. Trump on second reference, as we call it in journalism, but as President Trump. And I just thought this was fat. I'll just share a couple of them that are representative. Part of the reason President Trump has problems with the media shows in your biased writing. You refer to the president as Mr. Trump. You show no respect for the office or President Trump. No one media ever referred to President Obama as Mr. Obama, as they should not. You sound like a sore loser. Another one, F you, another liberal a-hole, as you all are. He is President Trump, not Mr. Trump. Obama's destroyed the country and all of you in the lamestream media. Another one, subject line, respect, question mark. Hello, Shane. It's President Trump, not Mr.
And the Chicago Manual of Style wept.
Right. So since I was not able to respond to all 50 of these readers, let me just say it is not a sign of respect or disrespect. On second reference, the president is always referred to as Mr. Senators are referred to as Mr. Members of Congress are referred to as Mr. I am certain that President Obama was called Mr. Obama. But I just thought
And that's the Wall Street Journal style.
That's the Wall Street Journal style. It is also, I believe, the New York Times style. In the Washington Post, you'll just refer seeing them referred to as Trump or the president. But I was more struck by just, first of all, these came all in one day. So I don't know if something was happening in social media.
It's an orchestrated campaign.
Right, exactly. But I found it very interesting that people were reacting to journalistic style as somehow a journalistic position, as if we were trying to demean the office of the presidency by calling him Mr. and not President. I'm not sure what to make of it. It was notable. And I'll be honest, it was rather unsettling to me.
So when I was at the Washington Post editorial page, we used to get complaints sometimes because we would always refer to the president and everybody else as Mr. or Ms. So-and-so. And we would get complaints in the actually the opposite direction, that it was too arch and too formal and that we should, you know, just say, you know, Bush or Clinton. And that there was something too formal about saying Mr. Bush, Mr. And so it's interesting that now it's sort of flipped the other way and it's considered a sign of disrespect to not be even more formal than that and use the actual title.
Yeah. And to be clear, I'm pretty sure these were mostly supporters of the president.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it does just sort of reveal that that people are bringing their own sensibilities about how to consume media. And now we're seeing a level of sort of suspicion or hostility that is necessarily new. I also get lots and lots of feedback from my public work. Some is more pleasant than others. Although one gentleman did write on Facebook, giving Ben and I the greatest and now go-to Lawfare insult, which is after a PBS NewsHour saying, your arms are fat. So now, which, by the way, readers.
This is really the most essential quality of the national security analyst.
I should pull it out as my subsidiary object lesson, because he said it twice. But there was just sort of a lyrical elegance to the way he said this. So now anytime anybody disagrees with me on Lawfare editorial decisions, I just respond with, well, your arms are fat.
That's great.
And for those of you who've never seen Susan's arms on the NewsHour,
she can pick up a toddler.
Imagine like Michelle that. Obama with like a, you know.
Only white.
Yeah.
Yeah. not
the first lady.
Not the first lady. Yeah. I'm trying to think of like the best.
You got pipes is what we're saying.
Arms. Yeah, Susan's got good
strong arms.
Right.
Yeah.
Dude. All right, Ben, what's your object?
So my object lesson I actually can't talk about. I'm just going to tell you what it is and then tell you why I can't talk about it. I just before as the others entered the Jungle Studio to record Rational Security, I printed some postage using a service. And I'm not going to tell what service it was.
Don't say it.
And I'm not going to tell you anything about my experience with it, because that service does not sponsor Rational Security. And so my object lesson is, you know, it's what could have been for a certain company.
This package efficiently covered in postage.
You know, and instead I'm just going to make fun of them. So if you work for stamps.com right now,
also please sponsor our podcast. Well, that brings us to the end of the show. Rational Security, which is not sponsored by Stamps.com, is, of course, a Spaghetti on the Wall production. You can find our show archive at SpaghettiOnTheWall.com. Wait, is it SpaghettiOnTheWallProductions.com? Yeah, it's SpaghettiOnTheWallProductions.com. You would think that I would know our own website by now. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security, and please make sure to send Tamara ideas for Tom Ricks's reading list. I think that's going to be really interesting. When you download the podcast, make sure you leave us a review and a rating. It really helps others find it. And we are word of mouth, so please do let people know on social media.
Run your mouth,
just
guys.
Like Mike Pesca shouted from the rooftops. We really appreciate all of that. Our audio engineer is Quinta Dresick. The show is produced and edited by Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by KT McFarland and the Lowell Brigade.
Excellent.
You can totally see her leading like a band of people like in an airport, right?
Yeah.
KT McFarland would make an awesome assassin.
Oh man, that's a terrifying thought.
I can't imagine her leading a band of deputies of the National Security Establishment, but I can totally imagine her leading a band like an
actual
band.
Yeah. It's not that she's just in the wrong job. That's all. Got other things for her. On behalf of my friends Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.